Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And we thought we'd take another one of our looks at a big company that's in the world of tech. And you know, it's been a while since we've done one of these. And we also thought we'd talk about a company that's involved in video games. It's one that has a long history in video games and a controversial one at times. This also has been something that numerous listeners have requested over the years. If you do not like video games, you have our permission to just, listen to an old episode.
But wait. But we promise that we're going to try to make it interesting, even for those of you who don't care that much.
Yeah, because there's a lot of impact that this has on the entire industry, and it's really, this particular story is pretty interesting. We're specifically talking about Electronic Arts, or EA. Which a lot of people view these days as some sort of a megalomaniacal corporation bent on dominating the entire video game industry.
Yeah, and it's Well, I mean, we'll get into it later on, but it is one worst company in America
twice,
two years in a row.
Yeah. But to start off, you know, it didn't start off as this company that was bent on having a stranglehold on the video game industry. And I'm not saying that that's what EA has now or that's what its goal is, well, but that's the popular perception.
That is. Well, you know, to be fair, it does, as of 2013, have 275 million registered players and is operating out of 75 countries.
Yeah.
So it's not doing too shabby.
It's not
for
a tiny
itself.
Company.
No.
But it had interesting beginnings. Now, to really understand how EA started, you actually have to go way back before EA was a thing. My first date that I wrote down was in 1953. Because that's when William M. Tripp Hawkins III was born. Now, this guy is going to be the founder of EA when we get up to that point. But it was his idea to start up a video game company. The way he came about this was as he was growing up and going to school, he started to get really interested in
computers in general and games as well. In fact, in 1970, he designed a board game. It was a football board game called AccuStat Pro Football.
He borrowed $5,000 from his father to get this off the ground, and it was a complete commercial failure.
Right. It was his first entrepreneurial attempt, and it failed, which often we can learn a lot more from our failures than our successes, but it teaches us a couple of things about Hawkins, that he's interested in games, and he's interested in football in particular, which becomes extremely evident during the evolution of EA.
Right, right. And he had started kind of designing stuff. He was a big D&D player, from what I understand, and was really interested in how all of the math and statistics worked, but noticed that a lot of his friends were not interested in doing that at all. And
yeah.
So he was kind of thinking, like, hey, what if?
Yeah, he was looking at different ways of creating sets of rules and statistics and also, at the same time, he was starting to get interested in computers. Now, in the early 70s, this is predating the personal computer. If you were interested in computers, it's because you had a job that there were computers at your job, or maybe you were attending university and there were computers there.
Oh, right, right. In 1971, he had his first interaction ever with a prototype microcomputer. This was over at a friend's house, and that kind of set him up for a couple years later.
Yeah, in 1973, he has access to a DEC PDP-11 mini computer, and he creates a program written in the basic programming language that was designed to run simulations of football games. So not exactly a fully interactive gaming experience, more like if I put in every player's stats and then set this to go and have it play out as if it were a game, what would the results be? And he tested it by running a simulation of what was going to be, at that time, the 1974 Super Bowl game. And it turned out that his game ended up predicting the final score fairly closely. In his game, it said that the Dolphins would win over Minnesota 23-6, and the real score was actually 24-7. So, at least in that sense, the statistics seemed to hold true. Now, of course, we all know that in reality, from a day-to-day basis, statistics can give you an indication of how things might go, but there's no guarantee that's how they will go.
Right. So luck could have certainly been involved in that one. But, right. Nonetheless, he was a student at Harvard at the time. He graduated with a self-designed major in strategy and applied game theory.
That's an interesting major right there.
Yeah, well, especially for 1973. Yeah,
right, right.
He says that he spent a couple of years convincing Harvard to let him get that degree because that was what he wanted, and would go on to get an MBA from Stanford.
Yep, and when he graduated in 1978 with that MBA, he went to work for a little company called Apple. And at that time, it really was a little company.
They had just about 50 employees at the time.
Yeah, 50 employees. He had joined early on. This is, of course, right at the very onset of the personal computer era. The Apple II was the first computer from Apple to really hit it off in the market. The first Apple was mostly adopted by people who were hobbyists or really had a fascination with computers, but it was not a commercial success. What didn't run away with the market? Apple II was a totally different story. That was the one that a larger niche began to get interested in personal computers. It still was still, kind of in the hobbyist era, but it was a looser definition of hobbyist at that point, not just people who were obsessed with computers.
Oh, right, right.
And I mean that in the nicest way. I come from a family that's part of this niche, so.
Yeah, Hawkins has said that in 1977, he saw an Apple II at a computer fair and realized that this was kind of, he'd been churning around this concept of games and computers and programming for a couple of years and decided that Apple was, yes, the way to go.
He's not the only one either. There were a lot of early game developers who were looking at personal computers as the platform of choice, and many of them showed an early preference for the Apple II. Richard Garriott of Origin also had that same fascination. So Hawkins works for Apple. By 1982, he was the director of strategy and marketing at Apple Computer. So
moved up, yeah.
Yeah, those humble beginnings. And of course, by then, Apple was doing very, very well. and had already had its initial public offering, which netted Hawkins quite a bit of money. Mm-hmm. And so he made a big, risky decision. He decided that his fascination of games and computers needed to really be indulged. And so he left Apple Computer.
Well, he supposedly had decided almost a decade prior that that 1982 would be the year for him to start a business, to start a computer business, and
wow,
that would be the year that the home computing market had caught up to his desire to play in it.
Now both of us honestly don't know whether or not that's truly what he thought. That's some of the stuff he says well after the time, right?
Yeah.
And it could be retconned is all I'm saying. I'm not saying he definitely did do that. I have a little bit of skepticism.
Either way, on May 28th, 1982, fun fact, the day before I was born, in case anyone needed to feel really old right now.
Thank you, Lauren.
You're welcome. He incorporated Electronic Arts, and this was not the original name that he had thought of for the company.
No. He actually originally wanted to call it Amazon Software. But that just didn't seem to really click. He got a bunch of people together to try and brainstorm an idea. He had actually used $200,000 of his own money to fund this early part of the company. And they started thinking about other possible names. One of the names they came up with was Soft Art. But the head of another company that was called Software Arts asked him if he would reconsider naming his company that just to avoid any confusion, and he agreed to do that. Had another brainstorming session and came up with Electronic Arts along with a team of other folks and marketing people as well, an outside marketing company. And Electronic Arts was born. They would actually receive, by the end of 1982, $2 million in venture capital from Sequoia Capital. And Sequoia Capital even gave them some office space to work out of before they had any sort of physical headquarters.
Oh, right. Very originally, I think he worked out of his own home when he was hiring his first couple of people. And all of these people that he was hiring at the time and the naming of the company kind of came about because he really wanted, he really believed that computer games are an art form.
Yes.
And wanted the game company to operate kind of like a music label. And this is really evident in some of their early marketing campaigns and attempts. You know, they would get these game developers together and pose them like rock stars, have rock music photographers come in and do these gorgeous photographs of them and really concentrate on the software artist.
Yeah, even the art they would use in the games they sold, which in those days, games didn't come in boxes yet. They were in usually plastic bags, and you had some art that would be included, but it looked pretty. It looked like a lot
stark,
of yeah. It looked like a lot of these games came out of someone's garage. And here's a fun fact: a lot of them did. but EA, they took an approach where they really put a lot of graphic design work into the art that was included with the games. And there were several sources I read that likened the art on the games to album art
yeah,
that you would see on what we used to, you know, buy music on, which were these giant vinyl albums. Actually, kids are doing that again now, but
they are. It's come back around.
There was a while where I would say vinyl album and I just get that blank stare. Those days appear to have disappeared again for at least a while, but we'll see if that keeps up. They actually moved to a headquarters in San Mateo, California, and they were there for quite a few years. Ultimately, they ended up moving again, but also EA expanded greatly, but we'll get into all of that. So their early efforts were concentrated on a few titles, and they wanted to produce all of their games internally. They wanted to be a publisher, a developer, and a distributor. So these are all different parts of the video game industry. And you can have a company that's just one of these things, or you can have a company that does multiple roles here. But to break it down, essentially you have publishers. These are the companies that fund the development of video games. Now, they might have a development team within the publisher, or they may pay an independent developer to create a game. But they are the ones who say, here's some money. We believe in the project that you have pitched. Why don't you go ahead and build that game? Then you give us the game, and we will make sure the game gets to distributors, who will then make sure the game gets to stores. And then the way it generally works, if you're talking about an independent developer and a publisher, the publisher will give an advance to the developer, and that advance is against any future royalties that the game sells until you pay off that advance. And then you usually have some sort of royalty sharing program where the publisher gets a certain amount of the money from sales, and the developer gets another, a percentage of those sales as well. But the advance has to be paid off first, because that's the initial investment the publisher makes to the developer. Developers are, of course, those are the people who develop the games. They're the ones who actually build the games. So again, it can be an independent company, it could be part of a publisher, it could be part of a distributor. There are all different types of models out there. But these are the people actually building the code, making the art, writing the games. That's
the
who
creative
those
end.
Are.
Yeah.
Then you've got the distributors. Now, these are the people who are responsible for delivering finished games from publishers and delivering them to retail establishments and other outlets. So they sell publishers sell their games to distributors, and then the distributors take those games and sell them to the retail operators, who then sell them to the public. So, EA was all three of these things.
Oh, right. And at the time, Hawkins has said that he had done a lot of market research and that 135 of his competitors were doing the same thing, which seems like an awfully large number. Although at the time in 1983, we were just on the verge of a little bit of a market crash.
Oh, yeah. A little bit is understating it.
Yeah. But during this boom, there was a lot going on. And also the concept reminds me a lot of Apple is a really terrific example of vertical integration.
Mm-hmm.
And from his time at Apple, I feel like probably that's one of the places where he picked up this concept.
Gotcha.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah, and those early titles that first came out, the first six titles from EA included games called Hard Hat Mac, which was kind of like a Mario clone. It's or Donkey Kong clone, I really should say, not Mario, but a Donkey Kong clone. It was a platforming game, not even a side-scrolling. It was, you know, kind of like Donkey Kong. Then you had the pinball construction set. There was a game called, which, you know, lets you build pinball systems. Then you had Archon, which was kind of a weird fantasy strategy game that was part chess, part action game. The idea being that you have two sides. Two sides have different pieces that are kind of like chess pieces. The different pieces have different abilities, and you try to take over your opponent's territory. Whenever one of your pieces comes in contact with an opponent's piece, you then have a little arcade-like battle
little
between
fight.
The two.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, cool.
And depending upon what your piece is, you might be able to really whoop up on your opponent because you're faster or your shots do a lot more damage. And so it was all about strategy. Like, I want to make sure this piece goes up against that piece my opponent has so I can win the game. You can kind of tell that I played the heck out of this game. By the way, I also owned the pinball construction set and I owned Hard Hat Mac. Then there was Mule, which was another strategy game. A lot of people who enjoyed this really like things like wargaming, where you would have the big table with all the hexagons
sure.
on it and you move the pieces around. Mule was kind of the computer version of that.
Yeah, it was really built for four players, which at the time was kind of unheard of.
Yeah, and I never got into it because my brain does not work that way. I can do well enough in Archon, because even if my strategy skills aren't that great, my Twitch skills were good enough to help me get by. But Mule, not so much. Then there was Worms, which was kind of a high concept game where you would train these, what they called worms, these lines of light to behave in a certain way in order to progress in the game. And it's very difficult to explain. And I've always seen people who say, if you want to play the game, if you want to try it out, find a copy of it and give it a whirl. I mean, you can find stuff like this on the internet. You should do it without reading the instructions just to see if you can figure out what the heck is going on. And I mean, I read a description of this and I'm not sure I would be able to figure it out. But maybe it's more intuitive than the descriptions would give you, than the descriptions seem to indicate. And then the last of the six titles that they launched with when the company was first offering up games was Murder on the Zindernuf, which I know nothing about. I did not own that one.
Yeah, I should put in that I have played zero of these games, I feel.
Well, they, you know, right around when you were one, so I'm not surprised. But I had most of these games because they came out for the Apple II, and we had an Apple II, and actually, what happened was a local school had purchased a bunch of games, and then they gave them to me to test and tell them which ones were educational and which ones were not really educational. So I did, and then I returned all the games. And they said, all right, you can keep all the ones that aren't educational.
Excellent.
Yeah, so as a kid, I was like, cha-ching! And so I ended up with a lot of early games. It's also how I ended up learning about the Ultima series, because Ultima 2 was one of those games. But, that was the initial launching title, but there were some other ones that came out shortly thereafter. There was The Last Gladiator, which is a game I also owned. Though that one didn't come in the batch. I won that one as a part of a lip syncing contest. Oh, yeah.
What pray tell were you lip syncing?
Me and my dad did a lip syncing routine to Ray Stevens' The Pirate Song, which is all about a pirate who wants to sing and dance and wear bright shiny pants.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, we won first place, which was a $50 gift certificate to a local comic store. And I don't read comic books, so I bought all their computer games instead. And one of them was The Last Gladiator. And that was a game where you play as a little gladiator and all these different monsters come out. And based upon whatever weapon you have at your disposal, you have, decent chances against them. And it gets more and more difficult as the game goes on. You know, it's kind of a typical arcadey experience. They launched a game that would end up being sort of the genesis of EA Sports. Dr. J and Larry Bird go one-on-one. I'm told this is from a sport called basketball.
That's the one. That's the one with the orange round thing, correct?
I want to say yes. Yeah. This was one of the earliest. It was the earliest sports game from EA, and Hawkins really struck on a brilliant idea. He had decided to try and approach people who were famous in various sports and to license their names.
Get that media tie-in, yeah.
Right, yeah. They get a promotional tie-in from famous athletes. I mean, Dr. J and Larry Bird were...
Especially at the time.
Famous.
Right.
And which is interesting because they were world famous since they were playing an American sport that was almost exclusively played in America. They ended up paying off big time. It ended up being a strategy that EA still to this day employs. They also established a new policy, which was to, in order to keep more of the profits that it would get from its, from the sales, it was going to reduce the discount it gave software distributors for its games, meaning that they were essentially selling their games at a higher cost to stores. Saying, all right, well, you know, we're no longer going to sell this game to you at $10 a copy. We're going to sell it to you for $30 a copy. And, you know, it's your problem to figure out how to sell this. So if you usually sell your games at $40, now you're paying $30 to sell it for $40. Your profit margin has shrunk as a software retail store. You know, do you continue trying to do that? Do you hike your prices up and hope that people are willing to pay it? EA's point was that, hey, we're starting to make a name for ourselves. People know our product and they like it. So if they like it and this is the only way they can get it, then you're going to have to play ball with us. And this is sort of the first example of EA really throwing its weight around.
Yeah. This was also the year that it made its conference debut at the Consumer Electronics Show. And so, yeah, they were really, really getting out there in the public and starting to make waves.
Yeah. And keep in mind, this is all in the first year that they're actually offering games. You know, they had been a company for a while, but of course, you know, as soon as they became a company, it didn't mean that they had games to offer everybody.
Immediately,
they had to develop them.
They
also had established these ideas that, you know, every single person who worked on the game was going to be credited. If you were the creator of a game, your name was front and center on the game's screens. It would let you know that this was a game developed by so-and-so. And that was a response to a lot of the activity they were seeing on the console market, particularly with Atari, in that there were people who were essentially anonymous game developers who had put in hours and hours and hours of time to create video games, but there was no sign of credit for them on the actual video games. It was just, you know, this is X title from X company.
Sure. Yeah. The word that I've seen tossed around in a lot of articles about it is serfs, that these people were being treated like serfs.
Right.
And Hawkins was saying that, you know, some of these kids that he'd met out at Apple were, and I quote, legitimate divas and that they deserved better than that.
Yeah. Let's make it clear, EA was not the only company doing this. There were other companies that split off from Atari, for example, that were founded by developers who wanted to have more control and more credit for the work that they were doing. So EA is one example of that, but it's by no means the only example of that. Now, in 1984, Larry Probst joined the company as the vice president of sales. And he will become really important to EA. He was already important at that point, but becomes even more so over the years. And EA begins to distribute games from other companies, not just their own company. So now they're becoming a distributor for other publishers. And one of the first ones was Lucasfilm Games. There was also SSI and Interplay. They all used Electronic Arts as a distributor. So now they're bringing in money not only from the games that they are developing in their own house, but also
from
other
outside
developers.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. This was the year that the video game market really crashed, or was really feeling all of the effects of the crash. And this was due to a lot of things, but
yeah.
But mostly, you know, Atari had been kind of sort of driving the market into the ground for a minute.
Yeah, yeah. The market was completely flooded with games and
not good games,
yeah,
necessarily.
Yeah, there were some great titles that were among the ones that came out that year, but Atari had essentially lowered the bar so far for anyone to submit games to the console that it was flooded with games that were just rushed, that had bad art, that were poorly constructed, that were impossible to play. This made people stop wanting to buy games because they were just not fun.
Right. And also there were so many consoles on the market. You know, it had kind of boomed, and these things cost $400 to $800 in today's concept of the dollar.
Right, right. Yeah.
And so, you know, yeah, it was not sustainable at
the time.
With the quality of games that were coming out.
There was such an early boom that it was just a rush, right? And then the rush was followed by a bubble bursting, which we see all the time, not just in technology, but in all kinds of markets.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, as a game company, Electronic Arts had a tough year ahead of it because, you know, it was affected too. Even though a lot of its games were being made for PCs,
computers.
Right. Mm-hmm. I was saying PCs, but really at this time we weren't really calling them PCs yet. But yeah, they were being made for computers. It still was affected because, you know, a lot of consumers got jaded on the concept of games in the first place. That was, however, the year that they published a game called The Seven Cities of Gold, which I also owned. I was known for being a terrible, terrible colonialist, I guess I should say.
Mm-hmm.
I would go in and wreak havoc on the various Mayan and Aztec cultures and plunder them. Yeah.
I've heard that it was a very educational game. Edutainmentable?
Yeah, I want to say that I bought that one, and that one was not part of the package, because if it were part of the package, then obviously I fibbed about it being educational. And then EA began to switch its strategy at this point when the video game market had crashed. And instead of marketing games as being from specific creators, the way they had been, where they had made these developers
rock stars, sure.
Right? They were instead going to look at creating actual brands and genres. So instead of saying from the mind of so-and-so, they said, why don't we find a game that really resonates with people and then just continue to create games within that brand.
That title.
Or even just within that type of gameplay. This would actually end up being something that people would criticize EA for years later, to the point where they...
Well, they've taken it to something of an extreme, but we'll get into that.
Yeah, I guess. And they also decided to start making games for lots of different platforms. So besides the Apple II, they started looking at the Macintosh, which was brand new in 1984, the Amiga, the Commodore 64, IBM compatibles, which were just starting to take off right around then, the Atari 800 and the Atari ST. So that's kind of where we are post video game crash. And there's a lot more to cover, but before we get into the second half of part one of the EA story, let's take a quick break and thank our sponsor.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, They have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, we're back, and let's go back into what's going on with EA. So 1985 comes around, and EA starts releasing a bunch of games, including some that were really famous in the fantasy gaming genre, the big one being The Bard's Tale, which I also owned.
I did not. I think I know. I'm sorry.
Well, it was very Dungeons and Dragons-ish. Mm-hmm. You would control a party of players. You would generate characters and then put them together in a party. And this was kind of standard for a lot of other video games at the time. Wizardry was very similar in this respect.
Right.
Where you would have a certain number of fighters, a certain number of magic users, maybe a thief or even a bard who could affect the way the party performed by playing different songs. That was one of the big innovative gameplay elements of The Bard's Tale. So, you know, play a little song and then everyone gets all amped up and they fight better. Or you play another song and everyone's starting to feel kind of chill and they start healing and faster.
That's terrific. Useful bards. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. As opposed to, and, there's this guy.
This guy's singing again.
We can't get him to shut up.
Mm.
We've broken four lutes and he doesn't get the hint. Well, the alternative title for The Bard's Tale was Tales of the Unknown Volume 1. And it was a fantasy RPG. And there was something really creative about the Bard's Tale series, which was that you could import players from other games.
Oh, right. On certain platforms, Apple II was one of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could pull in things from Ultima,
which was from Origin Systems. That was not part of Electronic Arts at that time.
Or from the aforementioned Wizardry,
which was from Surtek, also not part of EA. So these are games made by other companies, and it allowed interoperability in the sense that you could pull, like, if you had played this other game and you had these characters that you had developed some sort of emotional attachment to, and you had really invested in this game, you could then pull those characters into The Bard's Tale and use them again in a totally different game, which was kind of an awesome idea.
Yeah.
I will say that from my own personal experience from playing Wizardry and then pulling characters in from Wizardry into The Bard's Tale, they ended up being a tad overpowered. Like, to the point where the whole first section of the game was pointless to play because you just would, you know,
blast through anything
with an mm-hmm. It'd be essentially like if I were to encounter a moth and you were to give me a sledgehammer, you know, that's kind of the way it felt. But it was still a really cool game mechanic. Now, in 1986 and in 1988, they would release sequels to The Bard's Tale. So you get Bard's Tale 2 and Bard's Tale 3. I remember Bard's Tale 3 in particular. That was the one I played the most. And in 2004, we saw the release of The Bard's Tale. But this is a game that was not released by EA, nor was it connected directly to The Bard's Tale games.
But it was created by someone who had worked on the first two.
That's right. Yeah, one of the people who helped develop the maps in the first two Bard's Tale games was the developer behind The Bard's Tale, the 2004 game. So I remember being excited when that game came out because I thought, oh, they're relaunching this franchise that I loved as a kid.
Not so much.
Yeah, it was more just the name. It was still a fantasy RPG, and you played a character who was a very snarky thief bard character voiced by Cary Elwes.
Oh, man. Well, that sounds worth playing just for that performance.
It was entertaining.
Possibly.
You had a narrator.
The first 5 minutes, I don't know.
You had a narrator, and you had Cary Elwes' character, and they would bicker as you played. So that was kind of fun, but it, again, didn't relate back to the Bard's Tale games of my youth. So I was tricked. They are tricksy. 1985 was also when EA released their first productivity application, which was called Deluxe Paint. It was a program for the Commodore Amiga, which was known as a machine that was particularly powerful when it came to graphics and sound. When you compared it against the other computers, the Amiga blew them away as far as that. I mean, I had a friend who had an Amiga, and I remember just being completely flabbergasted that a computer could do what his Amiga could do as far as graphics and sound were concerned. Because when you compared it to my Apple II or my 286, it just it outperformed them hands down in that. So it was a great game platform. But this was a painting platform, or a painting application, I should say. And it was based off of an in-house art development tool that EA had been using that they called Prism. So they essentially took this in-house tool and then packaged it and changed it a bit for consumers.
He said, hey, kids would be into this too.
Yeah, like, you know, we're using this to develop games, but I think people would really be interested in using this for themselves. So, I mean, I'm sure they tweaked it so that it would make sense to a consumer.
Hopefully.
Yeah, or not just release it the way it was. I mean, because, you know, things make... You have different kinds of tools for people who are professionals in an industry and people who are just interested
hobbyists,
in it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that was an interesting departure from just creating games. I don't have anything for 1986. Oh, and I should say, I didn't say this at the top of the show, but we're not going to cover every release EA ever made.
Because, first of all, that would take us about 5 hours, I think, just to list every game.
Yeah.
And second of all, that would be a really boring podcast.
Right.
That would be like, yeah.
Even for our threshold, that would be boring. So we don't want to... No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. But no, I agree entirely. And so we're going to mention some of the big ones, obviously, especially the ones that ended up being disruptive to EA or to the industry. But in this case, we're just kind of skimming through some of the big ones and not hitting every single one. So 1987 was when EA set up a European division to market PC games. Now, at this point, it was just to kind of be a marketing firm, not a development house.
Right.
But they saw a lot of opportunity to expand into Europe. The problem with Europe was that it was very slow to adopt consoles. This is true later on when we start getting into the advanced consoles too, the ones like are the current
the
generation.
Or,
yeah, PlayStation forward. Europe, it's not that Europe was not interested in it, it's just it was slower to adopt it than other markets. So EA was trying to really invest in what they saw as being a huge
untapped
area for opportunity.
Source, yeah.
So that was the beginning of that. And in 1988, EA released Wasteland, which was a post-apocalyptic role-playing game. That's pretty, you know, innovative. There were some other post-apocalyptic RPG type stuff that was out for computers. Some of them were just text-based games, not even graphics games.
Right.
But
yeah, Wasteland is one that we are still not in the era of me playing video games that are not maybe Super Mario Brothers, but a lot of my friends speak of it with a lot of nostalgia.
See, the reason why I know so many of these EA titles is because I followed the same kind of pathway that EA did, in that I abandoned consoles shortly after the Atari era and moved on to PCs because I saw it as being a platform that would allow for more sophisticated types of games. And that's something that Hawkins himself had said as well. It's one of the reasons why EA in its early days focused on computers, not on consoles. There were other reasons as well. Like if you want to build a console or a game for a console, it gets pretty expensive from a production standpoint because you have to manufacture the cartridges. You have to build the ROMs directly onto chips. You have to build the cases, all this kind of stuff. And so there were higher costs associated with producing a video game cartridge than a computer disc.
Absolutely.
So they had their own reasons for really focusing on computers versus consoles.
But also, yeah, the console market didn't really recover until the NES came out, did it?
Yeah, yeah. Right around 88, that's when EA started to reevaluate this position of focusing on PC only instead of, or computers only, since PC we tend to think of as anything that runs DOS or Windows. But anyway, at that time, that's when EA was starting to really look at the NES and say, well, maybe there's a reason to get into this. Now, entering into any kind of agreement with Nintendo was something that Hawkins was a bit reluctant to do because Nintendo had very strict licensing agreements and standards that you had to meet because Nintendo did not want another video game crash.
Absolutely. They were being very careful about what they published.
Exactly. They did not want the market flooded with bad games. Not to say that every game that came out for the NES was amazing, but they were trying to keep as much of a control on that as possible. And, you know, that's something that publishers or game developers might view as being a barrier. You know, they might go through the trouble of developing a game only to hit a roadblock with the licensing problem, and then you've got all this time and energy and money that was spent on something that you can't actually sell. So there was a big issue there, but they did decide to start developing games for the NES, and the first one was Skate or Die, which my friends who had NESs, they loved that game. I did not have an NES, so I was largely ignorant of it. I was still playing the computer games at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just publishing the game directly and distributing it, they actually licensed it out to Konami. And then Hawkins said that the console market was still just unproven, that the crash from before was so devastating that you could not be certain it wouldn't happen again. And also, again, said that consoles were kind of underpowered when you compared them to computers. Now, they would later really revisit this, especially once the Sega Genesis came out. And their tune changes dramatically. But at that time, they were really saying computers are really, that's our main focus. Consoles are something we might do as a side project.
Sure.
So in 1988, they released a game that became one of the most important franchises in the company's history. And I am, of course, talking about John Madden Football. Hawkins has a lot of, there are a lot of interviews with Hawkins where he talks about his fond memories of developing that game, about bringing John Madden into the experience and saying that, you know, we would show him how we were doing things and then he would spend the next 20 minutes yelling at us about how we got it wrong. But it was always in an effort to make sure the game was as good as it possibly could be. So while Madden's approach was what some people might call aggressive, it meant that they were working on making a really good football game, or at least that was the goal. And it did become one of the most successful franchises in EA's history.
Yeah, as of 2013, there are 24 games out, and it's sold 99 million units.
Now, we'll talk more about some controversy with Madden Football, but that really plays in a few years down the line. In 1989, they began to develop games for the Sega Genesis console. And this is when they started to really rethink that approach and say, all right, maybe consoles are actually important enough for us to consider it being a main line of business, not just some little side business where we can make a little extra money. There might be some serious cash in this business.
Mm-hmm. Hawkins has said that that this deal that he made with Sega was kind of a crowning moment, and has said that he had been kind of stealthily reverse engineering the 60-bit Sega Genesis for a couple of years, and that when Sega found out about this, it could have gone one of two ways. Either Sega could have sued him a whole lot, or they could have created this kind of awesome contract for creating games.
Yeah.
And it went, you know, Hawkins has said that, yes, that this is one of his big wins in life.
He essentially said that he negotiated an incredibly favorable deal for Electronic Arts. This was something he could not do with Nintendo because Nintendo held so much of the power in that relationship. And, you know, when it comes to big business guys, you know, whoever holds the power, that becomes an important part of any deal. And it was certainly something that Hawkins was very concerned about. Even if you think back to the days of him saying, you know, I want this company to be about video games and art, you can tell there's still a cutthroat businessman lurking underneath that artist exterior there. And so, this was a great example of that. And in the fall of 1989, that's when Electronic Arts held its initial public offering, the IPO. That's when it became a publicly traded company. And Hawkins decided, in order to really justify going public and to get investors excited and invested in the company and to really increase the value of the company, to initiate a policy where every single month, he expected there to be three new games entering into the development process.
Wow.
Not completed, but entered into.
Yeah.
So, you know, that would mean that as time goes on, you have more and more overlapping games until some come out for publication while others are entering the development process. It set a pretty tough standard. Also, they were handling games from other developers at this point, too. So that this didn't even include those games.
Right, right. The company at the time was worth about $60 million.
Yeah. And of course, the value of the company now is in the billions. But we'll, again, address that when we get further up into
right.
the timeline. And in 91, that is a momentous year for both Hawkins and for EA. That's when Trip Hawkins decided to leave EA. He had felt that he had accomplished all he wanted with the company and that it was time for him to move on to something new and challenging. And that new and challenging thing ended up being 3DO, which was, the whole idea was he was going to create a video game console that would lead the market. It would be the most powerful, console. And it was predictive of the consoles that we see today. It was meant to be sort of an entertainment center, not just a video game console. But it was really expensive. And also, the games that first came out for the 3DO didn't get a lot of critical acclaim, and a lot of them relied heavily on full motion video. That was when full motion video was just becoming possible in the computer and console worlds. So people were using it a lot, to the point where it became a gimmick. You know, you thought that, oh, this game is good because it has full motion video in it. And, you know, full motion video, like any other tool, is just a tool.
It's just a tool, yeah. If you're using 3D, for example, these days, is just a gimmick. It's just a gimmick.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that was the ultimate problem with 3DO, which, spoiler alert, did not take off.
No.
It actually kind of languished.
Pretty hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, back at EA, Larry Probst steps in.
Mm-hmm.
He becomes the CEO of EA. Nintendo that same year in 91 launched the Super Nintendo Entertainment System, the SNES or SNES, if you insist on pronouncing it that way. And then EA began to develop games both for the Genesis and for Nintendo. And in an effort to really kind of hit as many fans as possible, they also said they prefer there to be lots of different consoles competing in the market because that means there's not one dominant player that can use the leverage against them.
Right.
You know, when there are a lot of different players out there, then EA has the advantage,
mm-hmm.
Which has been an important part of the company's
it's a really clever business standpoint.
Yeah, it's another one of those things that some people get a little. Well, I think people want games to be fun, and they don't want to think about the business end of it because the business end is not necessarily fun. It can be pretty
grim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was starting to take off right in 91, and that was when EA made its first real acquisition, which was Distinctive Software. So they bought an outside development studio. The idea was to kind of, they saw talent out there that they wanted to get. And instead of trying to hire the talent away, they thought, well, we're a larger company now. We're publicly traded. We're highly valued. Let's use this opportunity to purchase this other company and make it part of what we do. And Distinctive Software was the company that had created the Test Drive series for Accolade, which, of course, was a competing company to Electronic Arts. And so this same division ended up creating a new line of games for Electronic Arts called Need for Speed.
You may have heard of.
Yeah, you may have played those games. And then eventually Distinctive Studios was renamed EA Canada. And
it was located out in British Columbia.
That's correct, over in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And
That was 1991 was also the year that the EA established EA Sports as a division.
Yeah, so now we finally have an actual formal division within Electronic Arts that is overseeing the development of sports titles. And a lot of big sports titles came out of that division. Madden Football, FIFA, games that were related to hockey, to basketball. And of course, that'll become more important as well. But for now, I think 1991 is a good time for us to leave off. That was that big year, you know, Hawkins leaving and Probst taking over. And we can pick up again in 1992 in part two of our story of EA. So guys, if you have a suggestion for future episodes of Tech Stuff, whether it's a company we should cover or a particular type of technology or just a concept that you think we need to really explore, let us know. You can send us an email. Our address is techstuff@discovery.com, or drop us a line on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle there is TechStuff, HSW, and Lauren and I will talk to you again about EA, as it turns out, really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.